And a very good morning out there, everybody. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer joining you live this morning, right here from the big one, WHIO. And we're on air live this morning, which means we have the duty to take your phone calls. So if you have questions, if this is your new year to get healthy, then if you want to be on air with me, or even if you want to call in and speak with Mr. Parker Testa, who's standing by as my producer this morning, he'll jot down your question and we'll address it for you before this show is over. So don't be afraid. Give us a call. We'll make Parker work a little bit this morning, and he doesn't mind that. But I'm happy to take your questions live on air this morning. And if you don't know the number to call, I'm going to give it to you right now. So if you're outside our area code, you need to start with 937. If you're not, it's 457-1290. So 937-457-1290. That's the number to call. And Parker will take your call first. He'll get your name and your location, and then we'll go from there. But any topic that you can think of that you might be a little stumped on, or you may want to maybe a second opinion about, maybe you read an article over this little holiday break we've all been on, and you have some questions about that, feel free to give us a call, because I'll be here for the next hour, lie behind this microphone to take calls. But of course, I have a number of other great topics lined up for you today. And we're going to kind of bounce around a little bit, but we're going to talk a little women's health, we're going to talk a little men's health, and then we'll be standing by to take your calls. But I also have plenty of great articles to share, so if there aren't any callers, no big deal, but happy to do that. So if you wish to give us a call, please do. Now, we're going to start with men's health. And we're going to do that because men are typically very poor at handling their health problems quickly. And I'm a man. I'm not saying anything that I think most guys don't know and understand. And I think the ladies out there listening are nodding their heads too about their loved ones, their brother, their spouse, their father, their whoever they're related to on the man's side of health. Men are not good at picking up the phone and setting up an appointment. Okay, whether that means coming in to see us, going to get checked in by their medical doctor after several years of being away. And there's a multitude of reasons for that, and that's not the reason for today's program. But I want to issue just a little challenge to the men out there. And I'm actually kind of challenging myself on this too. There's a couple of tests I want to get done on myself here early this year that I've been maybe putting off for an extra couple months. I just need to set aside the time to get to the lab before my patient day begins. But if you're a man out there listening right now, and you've had something going on in the background that has caused your brain to spend more time deviating to that thought process about, I'm just not feeling quite as good as I used to, whether that's with low energy, maybe it's urinary changes, maybe there's some bowel and digestion changes. And I understand some of these topics are not things people want to call and discuss live on air, and that's okay. But if that's you, and maybe I'm hitting home right now in your world and in your mind, if you've been putting it off now for more than 6 months, more than 12 months, I guess the challenge that I'm going to issue to you to start 2026 is don't let the first quarter of the year go by before you move on that. And when I say move on that, you have the choice. You have the freedom of that decision-making along with your spouse and along with your MD or DC provider that you speak to on maybe a regular basis. Put together a plan on what you want to get done as far as tests to run on yourself to figure out what the heck is going on with you. And if you need some help in that area, I'm happy to be of help to you. We have great staff at our office, happy to screen and take those phone calls to get you to the right provider. But at our office, I am the board-certified clinical nutritionist, board-certified chiropractic acupuncturist, and a licensed doctor of chiropractic. So I have three real distinct ways that I can help patients in our office. And sometimes in the early phases, the patients don't even know where they want to start or where they need to start. And our office staff is excellent at helping you kind of navigate that so we can get some time set aside on my calendar, my schedule for the week, to take care of you completely and thoroughly. Because this is unlikely to be a 5 or 10 minute conversation. We need probably 30 to 45 minutes to at least figure out what's happening in your body so that we can determine what tests are going to be most useful for you. And then We're not just using the test just to run tests. We want to run tests on you so that we can come up with a unique treatment plan and treatment protocol so you can actually get better. Because, I mean, what's the use of a test if it doesn't give you any verifiable data to go and run with and put together some kind of treatment option? I mean, yeah, okay, screening is one thing. And then that leads me right into my topic that I wanted to discuss again on the men's health perspective. Because if you listened to me about 3 weeks ago, I was telling you about a patient that had prostate cancer. And his prostate cancer was very, very advanced. His PSA marker came back over 150. He had advanced cancer throughout his spine. So that prostate cancer had traveled to the bones of his spine. And he's got a real fight on his hands. And I'm helping him. He's got a medical team supporting him too. And I think in this case, he really needs both of us for his best possible outcome. But to transition away from his case, but back to another, the PSA marker, prostate-specific antigen. I was reading an article this morning in Medscape about how potentially the routine PSA screening may actually do more harm than good. And I have some statistics I can share with you, but I have a concrete example right here in front of me of a patient I took in August of 2025. And when I tested him in August, his PSA number came back at 10.9. And that 10.9, if you're a male patient out there and you've had your PSA checked, you know, is way too high. I say way too high. In the grand scheme of 150, 10 is kind of small potatoes. But in clinical urology, they typically use a cutoff of 4. So if that PSA marker comes back anything higher than 4, it's going to put you in that kind of higher risk group to be potentially considered for other medical testing, whether that's prostate MRI, some other advanced laboratory testing, or potentially even prostate biopsy if you're following the standard urology track on how to handle this. Now, this particular patient and his wife came in to see me in August. They already knew he had an elevated PSA, but they didn't know really what was going on exactly because he had had a previous prostate biopsy, but it had been several years since that test was done. And so he knew there was some enlargement. He had already had a CT scan and MRI of the prostate, so we knew that we were dealing with an enlarged prostate. But even from those tests, we didn't know for sure if we were dealing with cancer. And he had blood coming through his urine at times. He had about 4 to 5 episodes over the previous 6 months before he came to see me. So this is what I'm telling you guys, male patients, okay? If you've been dealing with something like that, blood in the urine, blood in the stool, those are never normal things. Okay, if your body's pushing blood out through your urine or your stool, you've got a medical problem. And yes, we can help you take care of that, but we're going to need some testing. We may need to order some imaging, and we may need to sit down and really, well, we're definitely going to sit down and figure out why this is happening. And there might be a really easy reason behind it, or there might be a more in-depth problem that takes another, way of assessing and looking at the situation. But to fast forward the tape, he comes in August with a 10.9 PSA. We know some of the background. He's had some episodes of blood in the urine, and we put him on a program in September, and he follows it pretty well, although he was coaching high school soccer here in the area during that fall season. So his time was limited to devote to really making good changes in his diet, his lifestyle, his exercise, reducing his caffeine intake, which for prostate patients, there's 3 really huge lifestyle things that need to be addressed right off the bat if we're going to have any success at reducing PSA. Okay, I say 3. I'm going to give you 4. Reduction in alcohol intake, reduction in caffeine intake, and smoking cessation. So quitting smoking. If you're a smoker, you got to quit smoking if you want your PSA number to go down. If you take in more than 1 or 2 drinks daily, you got to reduce that, or you got to reduce to that level at a very minimum to help get your PSA down, and you need to cut down on the caffeine intake if you're a high PSA patient. Those 3 things can be of benefit. They're not guaranteed to lower PSA, but those are things that you need to focus on. So now we fast forward the tape. He's in early November. His season has just ended with his team, and he comes in to get retested. And he and his wife had determined that if I couldn't help him get his PSA down, I say me, It's the protocol I put together for him, but he had to do it. And he admittedly didn't do it at a full 100%, but we thought he had done enough to maybe get an improvement in that PSA. Well, lo and behold, 2.5 months into the program when we retested, now the PSA for him is 15.7. That doesn't mean that my program and approach didn't work, because he came in and told me he wasn't really following it anyway, at least not to 100% level, which we needed at least 85, 90% commitment from him to kind of get that number moving in the right direction. But even with the best program that I could design for him, including nutrient support, dietary habits, reduction in sugar with the specific diet I laid out for him, it wasn't a diet. It was an eating and lifestyle change, make modifications to become a healthier patient overall. There is no specific diet to give to lower PSA, right? But it's a bunch of habits put together to create a healthier patient in this case. He's a 58-year-old male, still working full-time, of course, and that's fine. But his PSA goes up. He and his wife had determined if that was to have occurred, which it did, they were going in to get him another biopsy. Now, that wasn't necessarily going to be my suggestion at this juncture of the program, but that was something they had determined. Fine, no problem. Well, there are a few problems there, but that's, again, another topic for another day. But they decide to go in, get a biopsy, and I got a note back from him just this morning when I came into the studio here, and I'm catching up on some notes I missed over the last few days of the holiday. And I just have to get to it, so I might have to wait till after the break. I was looking at a bunch of notes this morning. But he wrote me and said, here it is. He wrote me and said, my biopsy results showed no cancer at all. Kind of surprisingly so. This is his note. So for now, he recommends, meaning his urologist, I come in for a follow-up in a year, potentially for a urocuff, a procedure they can do to make his urinary function improve, unless I experience increased discomfort. He says he's likely looking to change urologists because the doctor's okay, but the office is a mess and hard to work with. This is his note. He says, looks like we can concentrate on reducing inflammation and prostate health in general. And he says, however, I do want to make sure I stay on the quote-unquote anti-cancer lifestyle as much as possible. And so with that news, first of all, I was thrilled for him because when the biopsy comes back saying no cancer, that's, you know, A number one. That's all we hope for every time there's a biopsy result. And so I write him back and I say, yeah, of course, this is great news. Another shining example of how misleading an elevated PSA marker can be in the realm of only indicating cancer concerns. The issue around PSA is it elevates when there's pathological change happening in the prostate. It doesn't guarantee that it elevates just in cases of prostate cancer. There's about 15 or 18 different reasons why the PSA could be elevated, let alone prostate cancer concerns. But then I told him in my reply note, I said, absolutely, we have a plan for you. The anti-cancer pieces you are already following to the best of your abilities, keeping caffeine, alcohol, and smoking out are the three best starting points for everyone. And I realized some of that list doesn't apply to him. He's a soccer coach. He's not a smoker. But I put those things down so he can benefit from that information anyway. So that's the key piece. Guys listening out there, make 2026 your year to take your health seriously. I know we're rolling into our first break here. Parker's giving me that nod. So we're going to take a break. I know we have at least one caller online, and there's two of them. So please stay there. We're going to grab you on the other side of the break. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning on WHIO. And very good morning again, everybody. Thanks for tuning in, especially if you're cruising around here in the Miami Valley, listening on your car radio, or maybe you're holed up inside enjoying a cloudy, cold morning here and listening at home. Thank you for doing so. We're going to go right to the callers here. We have Evelyn in St. Mary's. Parker's going to help me. Go ahead, Evelyn. How can I help you?
Yes, I have a relative, a close one that has Raynaud's.
Okay.
I was wondering, is it an inherited condition? What causes it, and how can we help alleviate most of the pain?
Okay, perfect. So you were a little difficult to hear, but I think that I gathered you have a relative that has Raynaud's. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, perfect, perfect. So Raynaud's is or can be, there can be a genetic lean behind who gets Raynaud's. It's not a guarantee that if your mother or father had it, you will get it. But it does tend to run in families as a genetic condition. But here's the little kind of phraseology we use often around our office. Genetics loads the gun, but environment pulls the trigger. Now, I will tell you, Raynaud's is an incredibly difficult one to make a huge impact on. And the reason behind that is multifactorial. But we've had a little bit of success helping patients that have Raynaud's by giving them one particular B vitamin. And this particular B vitamin is called niacin. Niacin is one of the B vitamins that actually causes a flushing sensation to occur in the body. So it creates a little heat as that vitamin comes in and gets in the gut and starts to be broken down by our digestive tissues and digestive juices that are produced in our body. That nutrient goes to create better blood flow to all parts of the body. That's why that flushing sensation occurs. Now, I'm not saying at all that giving niacin is going to completely wash away the symptoms of Raynaud's, because that's not true, but it can potentially help the situation. I have two friends in my orbit that both suffer from this condition. And if you've listened to the show before, you know I love to play golf, and this prohibits them from being able to play in cold weather conditions simply because their hands won't function to hold onto their club well when the body gets too cold. So there's a variety of things that you can do to help the system kind of cope with this condition, but by all practical purposes, there's really no cure-all for this. It's still relatively unknown what really causes or drives the condition to occur. But like you said in the lead-in, yes, there are some genetic tendencies there on that one. So wish I had a little bit of a rosier picture to share with you. But niacin, from a dosaging standpoint, typically we use about 250 to 500 milligrams of niacin daily. Now, you can buy it in our office. You can buy it at area health food stores. But niacin, you want to make sure that you get the flushing version, because they also sell a non-flush form of niacin, which is called niacinamide, and that is not the one you want to use for Raynaud's. So appreciate your call today, Evelyn. I really do appreciate you listening. That was a great call. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
You're welcome. Thank you. Okay, sorry, I hit the wrong button there. Okay, good. And yeah, we've got a few minutes, but this is going to be a really good call. And so, Dave, please hang on for me. I don't have quite enough time to give it my full attention right now, but as soon as we come back from our next break, I will. And I know we have a couple minutes, so I'm going to use those for a different approach here. I wanted to talk women's health, and we will do that. We're also going to handle Dave's question. He has an interesting comment and question about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that's a condition near and dear to my heart, too. Not because of me, but because of family members that has really kind of spurred me on into taking up this career that I have. So I do want to talk about this. But for the female patients listening out there, I wanted to talk a little bit about estrogen metabolism. So we hear and know all the different things about what estrogen does in our bodies, right? At different varying life points, whether we're in a premenopausal condition or perimenopausal or even postmenopausal, estrogen plays different roles throughout the female life cycle. And one of the really, I think, kind of maybe often overlooked areas of estrogen is its role in musculoskeletal health. And anytime we use the word musculoskeletal, I think some people's brains kind of freeze up and fog over. But musculoskeletal is really simple to understand. It's the muscles that attach to the bones. Okay? So estrogen and how the body metabolizes estrogen is going to give us, or give women, and men too to some degree, because male patients have estrogen just at a much lower percentage in our bodies. That estrogen metabolism, if it's working correctly, is going to help us maintain our bone mineral density throughout all the varying life cycles in a female body. And I say life cycles, I really mean reproductive life cycle, okay? And I know we are creeping up on a break now, so Parker's giving me that eyeball. Okay, we gotta go to break. Thank you for listening. We're coming back. Dave, don't go anywhere. We're gonna have a really good chat right after this. You're listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning on W. Oh, I always love it when Van Halen brings us back. Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning, joining you live again. We're going to go right to Dave. Dave, I appreciate your patience. How can I help you?
Yeah, well, just to let you know, so you know who you're talking to, I've been a patient of Take Two Healthcare for, I think, about 20 years now. I started out with Dr. Merkel ever many years ago and have now been handed over to Dr. Yaley.
Okay.
But I'm highly concerned about a dear friend that I have. I probably should start by telling you that I think it was about October, he went on a carnivore diet to lose weight.
Okay.
And so then in November, he'd had a bump on his neck for some time. He had it checked, and they determined that it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Sure.
So then they determined that they wanted to do immunotherapy, and he just had his first treatment last Monday, and he's really feeling bad.
Okay.
And the whole thing seems counterintuitive to me. I mean, that to kill the immune system, what's your thoughts on that? And do you have a way of dealing with that?
Yeah, so this is, obviously a pretty critical and significant case here for your friend. And that's often how non-Hodgkin's and some of the other lymphomas are initially discovered, is there's a lump in the neck or somewhere up in that posterior cervical chain of lymph nodes. So right above the collarbone or clavicle is where they often find that golf ball size lump that indicates there's a problem. And so that's from start to diagnosis. And then now we're at the what are you going to do about it phase. And really in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, as well as some of the other lymphomas and leukemias, some of the chemotherapeutics are really quite effective. And now I don't say that lightly, because I'm not always a drug first approach guy or clinician in this case. But for some of the leukemias and lymphomas, undergoing standard treatment from a medical side, but also in conjunction with that, putting in nutritional support. And I don't just mean going to the health food store and getting on a few good vitamins. I mean getting thoroughly tested to figure out what your immune system is actually doing right now while it's actively undergoing chemo. Because, yes, the chemotherapeutic approach is to take these cells down to as close to death as possible and then bring them back. And so that's the standard way of treating it. Often in leukemias and lymphomas, it is a successful model, but it's not the only thing that I think the body needs in this case. Now, anytime we're talking about cancer, the word cure is one we never like to use, because we don't really think that that's possible, whether we're using standard nutritional approaches, standard medical approaches, or some combination of both. So now it's about how can we give this particular patient the longest and best life he can have, maybe with a married approach of standard medicine and nutritional support at the same time. And most often in current oncology practices, depending upon the oncologist's level of knowledge around nutritional support, and sometimes they do have a great deal of knowledge, and sometimes they're limited to their 3 hours that they had in their curriculum 18 or 25 years ago. And so I say that because they like to be the ones that tell you, the patient, you can't take this vitamin and that vitamin and that vitamin and that vitamin while you're actively undergoing treatment. And that's not always the case, but we do have to have the testing behind what it is we're trying to accomplish at some initial level with this patient, so that we can find out in 6 or 8 or 12 months if what we're doing is also helping the situation. Because each and every time before he goes in for his chemotherapeutic treatment, he gets a blood test. And he gets a blood test to tell the physician whether or not his white blood cells are within a normal clinical range, and that's quite a wide range, in this case down to about 3.0 on the testing scale. And as long as that patient's white blood cells at the onset of treatment are above 3.0, they'll give him the treatment that day. If his white blood cells fall below that 3.0 line, often they'll tell him, nope, you're not quite ready yet. You're going to take another week off or come back in 4 or 5 days and we'll test you again. Because
he's having immunotherapy rather than chemotherapy.
Ah, understood. Okay, that detail I didn't gather the first time. Thank you for that. So the immunotherapy piece is a little bit different too, in that it really kind of mirrors, really closely mirrors what it is that we do to help the body get healthier. Whether that's for cancer, for diabetes, for liver failure, you name it, we have to try to help support the natural mechanisms in the body that promote health instead of just fighting disease. Now, immunotherapy in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is a totally different ballgame. There's a variety of different drugs from all the different drug-making companies that tend to be used, especially when there's relapses in the case, so a second diagnosis or a recurrence of the same condition. So there's a variety of different reasons or approaches on why to use that. Has he been treated previously in his lifetime for a different cancer?
I don't believe so.
Okay, that's fair. And that obviously those would be some of the questions we would ask at his intake if he should elect to become a patient of ours, because even with immunotherapy support, there is a lot to be done. And I'll say in the background, we could say the foreground, but somewhere in this case, there needs to be some precise levels checked on vitamin D status. What are his white and red blood cells doing? How are his liver enzymes running? Because even those immunotherapeutic drugs can have effects on the function of the liver and pancreas that could just not allow the body to snap back as fully as expected. So I like the immunotherapy approach in this case, having not known all the details behind it, but trying to understand that using immunotherapy, even alongside some natural approaches to continue to work on getting him healthier, maybe his best option. Does he live here locally in the greater Dayton area, or is he out of state?
Centerville.
Oh, in Centerville. Okay, perfect. That's right where our office is, as you know, having been a patient for 20 years. So yeah, certainly let him know he's got great options out there. I don't mind, in this case, the immunotherapy approach. And he wasn't calling for my seal of approval anyway, but you're a concerned friend and a patient of ours. So just give him the word that we're out there and available to help. But he certainly sounds like he has several good options here, and we just want to make sure he lives as long as he can.
Yeah, well, the thing that concerns me, too, is, you know, he has to stay away from the public pretty much because,
sure.
You know, he can get, because they're killing the immune system or, you know, he can't be exposed to anybody that's sick.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where the vitamin D status comes in a super, super efficient way to make sure he's at least at 50 or higher on his blood levels of vitamin D. Not that that would change what he can do right now, but in the long run can help protect his immune system, his bones, his brain, all the things that some of these drugs can be given harsh side effects for. So, Dave, really appreciate your phone call today. Hope your friend takes you up on the offer to give us a call, but happy to help anytime and appreciate your call. Thanks. All right. Wonderful. Thank you, Parker. We're going to roll back in on the level of estrogen that I was talking about prior to taking Dave's call. And because this is an important segment and topic for female health, I promise you at the beginning, we're going to talk about male health and female health. So here we are at female health. So estrogen, why do we know, or how do we know that it plays such an important role? Well, most clinicians recognize estrogen for its role as a sex hormone, right? When we hear the word estrogen, we're thinking, okay, how does that help with reproduction, sexual function, et cetera, et cetera? But fewer clinicians actually appreciate the profound influence that estrogen has on that structural health that I was alluding to before, the musculoskeletal system. Estrogen supports musculoskeletal integrity by promoting muscle growth and repair, enhancing bone density, and stimulating collagen production. Okay, what is it that we need collagen production for? Well, we need it for two real main key areas in the body. We need it for soft tissue remodeling, which is the layering surfacing of our joints. So collagen is in our knees, in our shoulders, in our spinal joints. It's in every joint we have. It also gives our skin the integrity that it has. So obviously as we age, our skin gets more wrinkled, thinner, tends to bleed easier. You know, we get scratches and they bleed just for no reason. I'm not saying that's happening to me yet. I'm only 47. I'm trying to do everything I can to prevent that. But some people are dealing with that. Maybe it's a hormone imbalance. Maybe it's a vitamin K imbalance. Maybe it's an iron imbalance. There's several things that it could be. Maybe there's some genetically inherited tendencies there too. And there certainly are blood clotting disorders that are genetically inherited. But there's more to it than that, probably. Estrogen also has contributing influence on levels of inflammation. And if it's out of balance, actually increases our injury risk and pain threshold. So while we're just kind of programmed to think about its role as a sex hormone, it's really quite pivotal in determining whether it's going to act as a protective hormone and also help us fuel that musculoskeletal dysfunction if it's not in balance. So how do we know if it's in balance or not? Well, we have to test it. And it's not good enough, in my opinion, it is not good enough to test hormone levels with a urine test. There's a really, really prominent urine test out there that a lot of female patients have heard about, whether it's on Instagram or Facebook or some other social media platform, because I see it on there too. They promote it all the time, and it's called the Dutch test. Okay, full disclosure, I've never run a Dutch test in my entire clinical practice. I've been in practice for 20 years, and the reason I don't like the test is it measures urine metabolites for hormones. Okay, I liken this to when you take out the trash and you move your can down to the end of the driveway and wait for the guys to come and pick it up in the morning, that's what urine is. Urine is an output trash product. It's getting rid of substances in your body that the body no longer needs, wants, or requires. If you're going to test hormone levels properly, you need to look in the blood. Why? Because if you look in the blood, that's the place in the body where the hormone activity is actually happening. Doesn't it make sense? Just on a logical level, if you knew nothing about human physiology and you looked at testing what's going on inside you or testing in your trash bin, which one do you think would be more effective? I don't think it takes a genius to know that if you test what's going on inside you, you're going to get better, more reliable data. And the reason we need and want better and more reliable data is because it helps us make patients better. Isn't that the whole purpose? I mean, that's why I studied this hard for 8 years after school and then more diplomate degrees and 20 years of clinical practice. I mean, this is why we do what we do, so that we can actually impact somebody's life in a positive manner. Now, estrogen, if we test it in the blood, we can get some of the answers we need. Now, here's a key piece. And I was actually having this discussion with friends the other day as we were cruising around having some fun. One of our friends asked me, how can I make my bone mineral density better? Now, I haven't gotten a chance to review all her labs yet. We're going to actually do that sometime this afternoon. But when she was asking me about bone mineral density changes that she found out she has, I gave her this little nutshell explanation on how the bones actually get built. And here we go. Bone building happens in cells called osteoblasts. That's with a B. B for building, okay? So estrogen's role in this whole musculoskeletal health picture is that it stimulates osteoblastic activity, meaning it will help the bones build. And at the same time, it suppresses osteoclastic function. Now, the osteoclasts, I picture them as these little Pac-Men that are really super useful. They go around cruising around in the bone, and they actually chomp away some of the old, used up, bad bone cells that are in the bone. They chomp it away to make room for more new osteoblastic activity, because bones are a continually remodeling tissue. They don't just grow and at skeletal maturity, 22 to 25 years of age, stop right then and there. They're constantly improving or leading towards greater dysfunction if things are out of balance in our body. And estrogen is just one piece of this whole equation. Estrogen's role also helps us to maintain that bone density and prevent osteoporosis, right? So even if you haven't yet been given a diagnosis of osteoporosis, maybe you're still in that osteopenia category, and that's anywhere with a T-score between minus 1.0 up to minus 2.49. Because we slide that decimal point over one spot to tell us we've got 10% up to 24.9% bone loss. That's osteopenia. As soon as we break that 25% barrier on bone loss, it becomes osteoporosis. Can it be reversed? To some degree, yes. And I know we're closing in on another break here. We got to do that right now. But when we come back, we're going to talk more about what can women do to make their bones healthier. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning, the first Saturday of 2026 on AM 1290 and News 95.7 W. And we are back. Thank you very much. Final segment here. Great bump music today, Parker. Well done. Love it. Gets me pumped for the last segment. Okay, we're talking about estrogen. And there's a whole bunch. I could probably do three straight weeks of talking about estrogen, but there's a few take-home key points here that with the last few minutes remaining today, we got to hit. And we've got to hit them because you've got to know them or you're not going to get better. And first of all, you got to get tested properly. No Dutch tests. It's not going to tell you the answers you need. You need a blood test. You need a thorough blood test, not just looking at hormones, but it's got to be thorough on hormones because the hormones are controlled and regulated by almost every system in the body. Thyroid, liver, kidneys, blood sugar. These are all in some ways touching or upregulated or downregulated by hormone control. Okay, so we've got to test thoroughly and appropriately. You can't go in for your annual physical, get 17 blood markers on a few of your electrolyte levels and look at your cholesterol and say, yeah, I'm going to go on estrogen this year. It's not good enough, and it won't get you better. So you've got to test thoroughly. That's rule number one. Then you've got to consider a few key supplements if they're needed. And I'm going to rattle some of them off, but every estrogen imbalanced female out there shouldn't get out their pad of paper right now and write all these down and immediately go on them. You're missing the key point here. You got to get tested first. Okay? Some of the doctors out there in this community will do those tests for you, but if you want to get them done in the most efficient and cost-effective way, you need to call our office on Monday morning and get an appointment to see me this year. Okay? That's how you do it the most efficient way. I know there's other ways to do it, but they won't be as good. Here's the thing you need to consider. There's a particular nutrient called DIM. It's diendylmethane. Okay, DIM is an acronym for diendylmethane. This is produced inside of several of the cruciferous vegetable family of nutrients. Brussels sprouts, broccoli, to name a couple of the most common. So diendylmethane is one of the common nutrients we do use when there's a disruption in the estrogen metabolism pathway. Okay, it helps patients all the time. We see the improvements that they make when we do pre and post testing. The other things to consider under this category of needs is dietary fiber. And I was never a huge fan of using fiber supplements, and I still am not, because I think we really can, in this particular class of nutrient, count on our diet to give us enough fiber. If we're eating enough fruits, veggies, whole grains, seeds, nuts. These are all fiber-rich foods. So the aim for the day is 25 to 35 grams of dietary fiber, including both the insoluble and soluble form, and even prebiotic fiber types. So using a particular nutrient like a probiotic can also be helpful in this area, because those probiotics are the good bugs or bacteria. Some of them are yeast, good healthy yeast, that the gut needs in order to produce more of these hormones. Because if you look at where estrogen is made and built in the body, if we have competent ovaries in a female patient, and I mean ovaries that are still actively producing this hormone, which changes after menopause, of course, they still produce some, just at a lower level. So the ovaries produce about 20% of the estrogen for the body, meaning 80% of the estrogen for the human frame and human body gets created outside of those sex cells, those sex glands, whether it's ovaries for females, testes in men. And yes, testes in men do help produce some estrogen, but we have a far different level in the male patient than we do in the female patient. Or we've got big trouble on the horizon in terms of how healthy that patient can be. So we need to look at that. We need to look at properly testing the blood levels. We need dietary fiber. We need regular exercise. Why? Because exercise helps release good hormone balance in the body. I told you I was going to tell you what to do for bone mineral density. Here it goes. If you're osteopenic or osteoporotic, here are your three key nutrients. You need calcium, and not just any calcium. It has to be MCHC, 1,000 milligrams daily. Magnesium with malic acid, 2 per day. That's about 250 milligrams daily. And then vitamin D3. If you're getting those three things, you're doing everything you can to support proper bone mineral density. Now, again, I know I said time and time again, and we'll say it again next Saturday, you got to get tested first. I hope you enjoyed the first wonderful show of 2026. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer. Hopefully I'll be back with you next week, but certainly within the month of January, we'll be back. And you've been listening to Take Two Healthcare with Dr. Andrew Dyer as your host on WHIO.